Hey guys, this is welcome back. This is the first time. This is the first time I've done this. That we're doing the show since we
did it last.
We made the Didn't we make a blood pact?
I mean,
did we not
that I know of?
Did we not make a blood pact? Who did I make a blood pact with?
Oh no!
I'll figure it out later. All right. In the meantime, let's go to all new Smartless.
Smart.
Hey, you know, JB, somebody said to me the other day, you've become like the Jack Nicholson of the Dodgers.
Oh, yeah.
You're at the Dodgers. You're on the broadcast
a lot. What a high compliment.
I know. And Shawnee, you were there with him, and the guys were like, somebody said that the guys were like, hey, there's two-thirds of the Smartless crew, and where's our
we
buddy?
We had such a joy. Willie, if I had three tickets.
I know. Sure. Yeah. This is last week it was dinner, this week it's the game. I mean, you know, most people would be like, hey.
And Sean, we're still good for Rome, right, Sean?
Oh, this is what it is. You're getting me back for all the holidays that Sean and I went on.
I mean, the stamps on your passports.
No, we missed you, Willie.
We really did have a nice time, didn't we, Shawnee?
Oh my God, it was so easy, breezy.
We haven't done that in a long time. And it, you know, it reminded me, Willie, of I took you to the game one of the World Series last year when Freddie Freeman hit that walk off grand slam.
Oh yeah,
how good was that?
We were jumping around like
what was the last
beauty
game
contest? The last game of what?
Was that the famous last game last year where
it wasn't
the
last game? I believe it was the first game.
It was the first game, and it was a
World Series. Yeah,
where he just like got a bases loaded home run the last.
And then the series continued for the Yankees to go ahead, and they kind of dropped the ball on the whole series.
Get it?
Yankee fans will know that pun.
Oh gosh! Well, there we go. You alienated 50 million people. So
listen, the Yanks are going to get another chance. Well, who knows when this is going to air? But
we don't know
when
this
seems
is going
to air. They might get another chance.
I also look at what I just fucking did like 5 minutes before we came on.
What'd
playing
you do?
With the dog outside, and I ran inside and I fucking tripped over him, and to break my fall, I grabbed the door, and this finger went all the way back here.
Oh God!
Really?
Yeah, just like 5 minutes ago. I was like, oh.
Wait, so you're on ice right now?
Well, just in case, yeah.
Yeah. Well, buddy. Luckily, I'm no joke. Luckily, you're done with the play.
I know. Could you imagine? Could you imagine?
No.
No. Couldn't play. Wouldn't be able to play.
I know.
Oh, that Ricky.
It would be good night, Oscar, if that were the case. You know?
Incredible. Wait, Sean, why have you asked me and then my wife separately if my dogs are good with other dogs?
I want to bring Ricky over, but I don't want to bring him if your dogs are going to attack.
Why would you be bringing Ricky over?
Because I might come see a movie this weekend.
Okay.
But you spend 3 hours plus over at Jen's every week. You don't bring Ricky.
Look at the judging face.
I just
don't understand. Like, what's going on? Is Ricky having separation anxieties lately?
No. It's just a thing. And as a dog owner, I just don't like to leave him alone for like 3-4 hours.
JB, I would describe your face as a scowl right now. It's a scowl.
No, I would like to bring him over to Jen's, but they don't get along.
Well, yeah, but
so I was like, oh, if your dogs get along, it'll be great. I could just bring them over. And if not, by the way,
no,
that's
they
fine
get along,
too.
But the bigger issue is why do you and Scotty feel like Ricky needs so much constant, like dogs can be left alone. And by the way, you just spent almost a full year out of the country.
I know. I don't know how he fed himself. He fed himself. I don't know how he drove himself around.
Listen, this is going to be controversial, but we live in an era where people bring their dogs over to other people's houses a lot. And I'm not judging you, Sean, on this, but people do it. And they're like, I got my dog with me. I'm like, what do you mean you got your dog with you?
It's not okay.
Yeah. And I'm a dog. I love dogs. I've had lots of dogs. I have a dog. But you don't need to bring your dog with you when you go to somebody else's house.
I like the dog.
I'm not saying that you don't.
Then continue having more morning playtime with him then.
Yeah, people show up, I got my dog with me. Oh, you've got your dog with you?
Yeah.
What if everybody brought their dog everywhere? It would be mayhem.
This is what I love. This is what
I
love.
You're like, I'm a dog person. You must be you're a monster.
Oh, sorry. He peed. Where are your paper towels?
No, this is what I love the conversation that I know happened this morning and Jason's face as he was having it with Amanda.
It was a couple days ago and I've been really stewing on it.
Amanda's like, Sean just texted me if our dogs are okay with other dogs. And you turn with your cup of coffee or just sludge, your cup of sludge.
And I said, fucking what?
What?
By the way,
he did the same thing to me.
He's in his chair in his little study with the fire going and he's watching MSNBC.
What the fuck did he say? Yeah.
And then he barely moves and he looks at her and she's at the door because she's too scared to come in because she sees the pre-scowl. Who knows what stage of gummy he's at? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I will scratch.
Randy's afraid of dad.
Yeah.
You know?
She does a very tentative little...
Yeah, a little knock.
Yeah.
Honey?
Are you not on commercial? Is it not commercial?
I guess, I tell you who's not tentative is our guest today.
Nice.
Oh, let's get into it.
Yeah. Hang on a second.
Check the chat.
Hang on one second. What does that
say?
Yeah.
By the way.
Sorry. Before we get into our guest who we want to talk to immediately.
Yeah. Tickets to the Hollywood Bowl, November 15th. For Smartless Live.
Wait, do I need to buy tickets for that? I'd really like to go to that. Do I need to buy tickets?
No, we're giving you two comps.
We're going to give you two comps.
One for you and then plus one. You get a plus one.
I'd love a stage seat. If you have a stage seat.
Stage. You go to smartless.com/live.
So you go to smartless.com/live for the Hollywood Bowl show on the 15th of November. Guys, this is going to be... It's going to be very nerve-wracking for
it
us because what are we doing up there at the Hollywood Bowl?
We can barely do this. We're barely doing this morning.
I will tell you that my guest is one of our biggest stars in the movie industry.
So is my guest.
Really?
Really?
Yes, my guest also is one of the biggest stars out there.
Let's have a little side bet, you and me.
I can't wait. I'm going to have a single up on a camera. We're going to single up on you. When my guest comes out, gets announced.
Oh, and you'll know why.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great. Listen,
it's going to be a guest that's going to make me nervous.
It's going to be so great on so many levels. I can't wait.
All right, you can be the judge between Will and I's guest. Let's you and I have a little side $10 bet of who is the bigger guest.
Okay.
And Shawnee, you get to decide. And
all right,
then,
we'll just do it like go. We'll do 10, 10, 20.
A big reveal.
We'll do a 10, 10, 20 and presses.
It's automatics.
Automatic presses. Okay. All right. Well, I'll tell you what we are. We're pressed for time because we want to get into our guest who is, get this, award-winning actor, writer, director, New York Times bestselling author.
What?
Podcaster, singer-songwriter, multiple albums, multiple Golden Globes, multiple Emmy nominations, SAG Awards. He's known for his iconic TV show, which was his sort of breakthrough, even though he'd been doing it for a long time. He's got a degree from Princeton. He's got a master's from Yale in literature.
Oh,
he still has unfinished PhD that I want to ask him about.
I'm
he's one of the all-time greats. You guys, it's David Duchovny.
Oh, David Duchovny.
Hey, David. Wow. Was that not David who you were going to guess, Shawnee?
No, I thought it was David Duchovny or Louis C.K.
I don't think Louis has a master's in literature, all due respect to from Yale.
Yeah,
but you said Princeton. You said Princeton as well.
And Princeton first.
Is that true?
Jesus
David, welcome.
Christ, David.
Is it true? Yes, it's true.
Yeah. Thank you. God.
This is so wonderful.
David, why would you, you're such a, you know, I remember we spoke about a year ago. Where you
Let
had
me just
dinner.
Say, I don't like the tone of that. Why? Immediately. Yeah. Why?
Why would they give you a degree? No, it wasn't that.
Why?
It wasn't that.
No, go ahead.
Why would you, because you graduated, you were head of your class in high school, and then you go to Princeton, and then you go to Yale.
Jesus.
And then I feel like you lowered yourself to come into show business a little bit.
Yes.
You know, a little bit. Why would you do that, David?
Clearly, I have a gaping hole inside me. That
to be filled. You decided to slum it.
Yeah.
You slummed it with us morons.
Yeah. What is that?
What? Go ahead.
No, that's it.
What? No, I want. I want you to walk me through your academic prowess. I'm fascinated with all this stuff.
Well,
At Princeton, I majored in English literature, Jesus. And I wrote my thesis on Samuel Beckett's novels.
Come on.
Wow.
Because, well, let me tell you why I wrote on the novels, because nobody writes on the novels, and I didn't have to do that much work and research, because I could just make the shit up myself.
All right.
This is nothing to compare it to.
Yes.
No ChatGPT cheating.
It was an open field.
And then what happened at, that was Princeton or that was Yale?
That was Princeton. Wow. And then I took a year off and I traveled and I didn't really know what I wanted to do at all. I just knew I wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And then I applied for a Mellon Fellowship, which I got from the Mellon Foundation, which they were trying to lure people that might go into money-making businesses and steer them towards academia. So it was for people to get PhDs who might, you know, not be able to afford staying in school. So I got one of those and I went to Yale. And I thought that I'd become a professor of English literature and then write novels in my summer times. That was the plan.
Wow. Christ. And forgive me, have you written like 100 novels and I'm an idiot?
I've written four or five novels.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I just had a book of poems come out. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Wait, David, yeah. This is...
And then, and by the way, he's also, he's admitting the fact that he's put out a number of records. He just finished a tour. Am I right? You just finished a tour in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this was in the States, this one, but go ahead.
But last year you were on tour in Europe.
Yeah.
And I listened to your records. By the way, your music is great. And you know,
oh, thank you.
Sometimes, and I mean this with all due respect, sometimes when you see people who do multiple disciplines, they're like, I'm going to put a record out. You listen to it, yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. Your records are really good. I mean, they're very, these aren't just hobby
Will's got very
records.
Good musical taste.
And I'm a music lover. Yeah. Really, really good stuff. I mean,
thank you, Will.
I love
hear
that
it.
Tune, Hell or High Water. I think that's a great thanks. Tune. Yeah, it's super.
What type of is it? Rock and roll?
Yeah, I guess it's. I'd say it's rock and roll. Yeah, like 70s rock. You know, late 60s rock.
Like yacht rock.
Not quite like yacht rock. I'm not. I'm not very jazzy. I stay off the water. I try to stay off the water.
No, it's kind of like indie rock in a way. I mean, sorry to forgive me for saying that, but I'm a 90s indie rock dinosaur myself.
Yeah, it's well, the 90s was kind of like the garageification of 70s rock in my mind.
You know, interesting.
And so I think 70s and 90s have a lot in common.
And you're playing the guitar there and you're singing as well?
I don't play the guitar on stage because I'm kind of self-taught on the guitar. So I have an inability to play it the same way twice, which is not very nice for my band.
So I
write the songs.
Do you sing them?
And I sing in my in my fashion.
Yeah, so on stage, fashion. you have no guitar as a crutch.
I have nothing to do with my hands.
You just kind of work the mic and the
cord.
You
hold on to that fucking mic stand for dear life. That's what happens.
I wouldn't know what to do.
It's like a life jacket.
You're like Liam Gallagher does that. You know, with the
Liam is amazing because amazing. when I first started performing live, I just thought, well, I'm like the MC. I want people to have a good time, you know, and I'm dancing around and making a fool of myself.
Well,
and
then
it was actually my wife said to me, you know, you don't have to move around so much.
Oh, no.
And then I saw Liam, and Liam is just still. You know, he's just still. He's got his hands behind his back for the most part.
Yeah, kind of leaning up in a way.
And
you
it's really powerful to be still.
Yeah.
Do you close your eyes a lot?
Sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes I close my eyes and then I go, this isn't good. There could be shit happening out there that I need to keep an eye on.
Do you ever go full Sia and just turn your back to the audience?
David, you were self-taught on guitar. I think you only started playing guitar a couple years before your first album. Is that true?
True, yeah.
So you barely you basically teach yourself how to play guitar for a couple years, then you have the audacity to be like, all right, well, I'm going to write a record. And how are you, do you know how to read and write music? How is that process?
No, I don't know how to read and write music. But here's something that you guys might appreciate as actors. When I decided I wanted to learn guitar, I'm not 100% self-taught. When I decided I wanted to learn, I was doing Californication at the time. And I said to Tom Kapanos, the producer, I think Hank Moody should learn how to play guitar, so I could get the free lessons.
Oh, that's amazing!
The intelligence permeates everything you do.
I know. He's playing four-dimensional chess, if that's a thing.
So I also with singing, I'm not like Sean. I can't. I'm not that kind of a singer.
I'm not either. Which is
yes,
sad
you are.
Yes,
and
you are. How dare you?
It's been a journey to try and put over the song because I can hear melodies that I can't necessarily sing, which is weird. I never thought that was a possibility.
Well, so, you know, I'm just really quick. Sometimes the best singers are the quote untrained singing, you know, because you don't think about it. You're not in your head about it.
You know, David, when we had Michael Stipe, our friend from REM, on here a while ago, and he was talking about that.
Wonderful singer.
He was so good. And that first record that he made when he was down in Athens, Georgia with those guys, Radio Free Europe, I think, was their first single. And he was talking about, he basically was singing gibberish and he didn't know how to sing. Do you remember that, guys? And he was talking, he was like, I just kind of winged it.
Yeah.
Because he didn't know what and he kind of taught himself how to, and he got better.
I think the correct term is wung. He wung it.
Sorry, Jason.
I don't mean to embarrass you. I'm so sorry.
Stickler. He got a master's in English from a school bus.
So, hey, Sean. Hey.
Yeah.
Okay.
That really, speaking of music, struck a chord with Sean.
Now, David, this is, I don't read, and I'm not proud to say that. Mm-hmm.
You strike me as a reader, though. I'm surprised to hear
I appreciate that.
He reads scripts. But he doesn't read.
A lot of this is the glasses.
It's just the glasses.
But to be an English major and to say you want to be a writer and you are a writer and to be a professor, it sounds like a lot of reading. A lot of sitting down.
Can't get anything
with
by you.
Nothing else going on. There's total silence in the house. Maybe there's a little bit of classical music or something. Nothing with lyrics, because that'll distract
you. No, exactly right.
But, like, and Will, I wanted to ask you about this, too, at times. Yeah. And then I just said, fuck it, I don't want to talk to Will. how do you do that? How do you just say, of all the things I could be doing, I would rather just sit in this chair and shut out the world and stare at this stack of paper and go left to right, top to bottom, word after word after word after
word. So I'm not reading Hebrew at all, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's what you're...
I mean, I wish my parents, for all the good that they did, I wish they had somehow tricked me into really loving that process.
Enjoying
because
it,
there's so much that I'm
missing.
Are
you talking about writing or reading?
Reading.
Reading,
Writing I've got, but it's the reading that's... I don't know.
Have you ever loved reading a novel or reading?
I have. I backed into a couple of those, but it was, you know, it wasn't by choice. I do not read for pleasure.
All the jokes, JB, that I make about you not reading, I will say of the handful that I mentioned that you have read, you've always said you really enjoyed reading them. So that's what's surprising to me.
It is the time allotment. It is the decision to go sit in a chair in a quiet corner of a house and shut everything out and do that. There's so much discipline and that I have for other things, but I just don't have for reading. I'm so envious of that.
Yeah.
I think it really comes from my parents, I think. Yeah. On my mother's side, she was from a small town in Scotland. And the only way to advance for her family, which were generations of, I did that Finding Your Roots show.
Oh,
so I found out that I come from a long line of fishmongers.
Oh, yeah.
wow, that's wild.
So the only way out of the fishmongering business, in fact, one of my ancestors' occupation was widow of fishmonger.
Oh. And I didn't even know that was a job.
Not high paying.
I was like, how does that pay? How does that pay? not well, is my guess.
Well, you need the person to die, first of all. Yeah. So, I mean, that's
you need to be included in the will.
And so the only way out of that place in society was education for my mother. Mm-hmm. So my mother was the first person in her family and a woman in the 1940s to go to college. And so she was very much just somebody who believed in the power of education and of reading and writing as a social climbing tool.
Mm. Wow. The appeal of reading sometime like the pure escapism of, because I do remember this one book I really enjoyed reading once. I was once on a job that I didn't
I didn't enjoy. I didn't like where I was. I was on location somewhere and I was lonely. And it was great to just like, I was dying to get back into the book any chance I could because it would travel me from where I was.
That feeling is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it used to be, you know, I think the place of books has been taken by, you know, TV and movies, you know, that escape. But before there was that technology, you know, this is what you had.
Right. You had the book, and people used to read books on set. I think way back in the day, you did. But JB, I would say that you, as somebody who travels a lot, you're on a lot of, you're on planes a lot.
Yeah,
that's such a great time to get that escape where you're not watching.
Can I send you one of my books?
Yes,
Jason?
Please. Yes,
I'll send you one of my books for a plane ride. It's Baseball Contingent. It's near baseball. It's called Bucky Fucking Dent. I made a movie of it. I made a movie of it, but I want you to read the book. I'll send you the book.
Now, that sounds like nonfiction.
No, it's fiction.
Is it?
It just uses that moment in time as a jumping off point.
Okay, and then does that make you a big Yankee fan?
I am a big Yankee fan, and I heard what you said earlier.
You got a big day today. Big day today.
So, David, all of this to say...
So then my father's family, his father... wrote for the Forward, which is was the only Yiddish daily newspaper in America, the longest running one. And he wrote kind of in a Dickensian way, he wrote cliffhangers for the paper. He wrote, you know, stories about Little Nell or whatever, somebody being tied to the train tracks, that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So, and my father, his entire life, my father had to work kind of a 9-to-5 job, but he always said he was a novelist. He always said he was a novelist. And at the age of 73, 2 years before he died, he published his first novel. So he was a hot young novelist at the age of 73. So I'm coming out of that kind of history of respect for the word, respect for the efficacy of the word, respect for education. Just it was all, that was part of my growing up. That was part of my foundation.
And we will be right back.
And now back to the show.
That's funny, David. My dad also, who worked forever, and but he's been retired for a while, but since COVID has written 2 novels.
Amazing.
And he wrote his last one. He came out when he was 86. He's just written it.
Oh my God.
Last year. Yeah.
What is the name of it, and where can purchasers find
plug it?
Yeah. Well, his latest is The Monmouth Manifesto, which is an interesting novel, and it's sort of historical fiction, if you will.
This is about when caterpillars change into.
It's about the American Revolution in a way. Monmouth County, New Jersey is a reference and about loyalists going to Canada based on one of my ancestors and about really at the heart of the revolution. And
I was just trying to do a moth joke.
Okay, sorry. You don't want to get into it.
Not really. This is why you're Canadian.
Let the readers buy it and discover it.
What's his name?
My dad's name is James Arnett.
Okay. You sure?
Yeah. Emerson James Arnett, if you will.
Oh,
yeah.
EJ. My dad wrote me off.
So. Sean, it would be funny if it wasn't so true.
He
wrote me off.
No,
all right.
He wrote a goodbye note. Is what he wrote. See ya. That's where bye came from, by the way. It came from Sean's dad. Bye. Wait, David. So you graduate, you go to.
I kind of want to stick with Sean.
But I know I do. Well, we've done a lot. Anytime you have a question on Sean, please interrupt me. But you decide you're studying English lit and you get a master's, and then what's the moment you go like, all right, I'm going to put this down for a second. I'm going to dip my toe. What was your first acting job and why did it come about?
I was at Yale. I was getting my PhD or so I thought. And Yale is famous for its drama school and they have a lot of productions going on all the time. So I decided I was going to start trying to take classes over at the drama department and they were very loose about it. They would just let me walk in and do writing classes because I thought, maybe I'm going to write plays because the idea of writing novels or poems seems so very lonely to me, you know, and I was 20, 22, 23 years old and I was just sitting in a room all day long alone trying to write. Mm-hmm. I was like, this is fucked up. You know, this is not, You know, I like people.
Not as romantic as you thought.
No,
it was
but I liked. I like collaborating. I like. So I thought, okay, I'll write plays, and that way, at least I'll get out into the world. And so I met all these actors, and they're always looking for bodies because there's so many productions going on around in Yale. Yeah. And they said, hey, you know, come and do this thing, this Arthur Schnitzler play we're doing, which name escapes me, but you can play the Count de la Tremouille or something. I had one or two lines. And I liked it. It wasn't like, oh, this is a revelation. In fact, I thought, oh, well, I'm comfortable. And I was so comfortable that in between the first and the second performances, I smoked a joint.
How'd the second one go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so good. Yeah. Not so
good. That's really funny.
I was so cocky. I was like, I got this. And then I was like, oh, I don't have anything. Why are people looking at me?
Did you then sign up for acting classes?
I started taking classes in New York with a woman named Marcia Haufrecht, who taught Strasberg Method. She was associated with the Actors Studio. And that was wonderful because she was completely supportive. You know, it was all about the interior world, all the things that are so difficult to work on when you're actually a working actor.
But were you thinking about it in terms of like informing your playwriting? Was that part of it? Yeah.
Yes, that's what I was telling
myself. So it wasn't like this is going to be my future occupation.
No, I thought if I'm going to write plays, I should probably know what it's like to say these, whatever lines I'm going to write, see if they're sayable up on stage.
Yeah.
And so that was my approach. And then at some point I was just like, I'd played sports my whole life, and I liked the team aspect of acting and of making things. I liked the high wire kind of, you know, put up or shut up feeling.
Did it ever frustrate you that it didn't hold the same sort of academic rigor?
No.
No. Because it is not, with all respect to our colleagues that are actors, it doesn't have this sort of highbrow, sophisticated reputation that a playwright
would. It's just a different game. It's like baseball and basketball, whatever. It's just, I look at life as a series of games or setups, and this was just another game, and I knew it had different rules, and I knew that I would have to examine different strengths in order to
probably less constraints too than writing, and it, because it is such a different discipline. It probably started exercising a different muscle creatively that you're like, oh, this feels good.
Yes, it was the emotional aspect of my life, which had been neglected because I was, you know, I was in academia, which doesn't really prize being volatile.
Right. So the emotional side of it and the teamwork side of it is being satisfied, but. Do you feel like this fucking academic superhero that you have inside of you has been satisfied, has been utilized properly in your life thus far?
Yes. Now that when I started writing novels about 10 years ago now, and you know, people, I go on Goodreads and I'll read, you know, people's suggestions.
Yeah.
Oh, you will. You will.
Mm-hmm. Stupidly, yeah.
Yeah.
But people.
Yeah.
I will be accused of showing off my learning when in fact I don't write with any books around. It's all in my head. You know, if I'm quoting something or if I'm referencing another a great work of literature, it's coming from my head. It's coming from my memory.
That's
crazy. So I'm not
That's
doing
amazing.
It just to show off, but it's part of me. And I really feel like I finally joined in the conversation with these people that I grew up reading and loving and feeling like this is the conversation I want to be involved with. And I'm sure you guys have had this as actors where you're like, okay, now I'm in conversation with the people that I want to be in conversation with.
That's true.
And then did you ever end up writing any plays or any screenplays? Have you kind of married the two?
Yeah. In fact, the novel writing came out of not being able to make a screenplay. Bucky Fucking Dent, I wrote as a screenplay probably in 2005 or six.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't get it made. You know, these are usually my soul goes towards like more independent kind of stories.
Yeah.
And so Bucky, I couldn't make. I got close. I couldn't
make it.
But
then finally did. Yeah.
And then I was like, I'm going to write it as a novel, and then I made it as a movie.
So you flipped it. You went the other way, so you write a screenplay.
Because Will always talks about it. It's IP now, because now your book is IP. So they love that, right?
I don't know if they love that.
Reverse engineering. I mean, no, Hollywood loves that. Was it a book first? Then we'll
I'll
make
just
it.
Say that as a director, you know, writing the novel of the screenplay was the best preparation I could have done as a director.
Yeah, sure.
Because I just knew.
So now
I'm not suggesting that you have to do that next time you direct, guys.
No, yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm just saying, for me, that worked.
Yeah.
Is there a genre of that you like writing more of than not?
Oh, I mean, I'm just of the, I guess, you know, I go back to the movies when I started acting, you know, like James Brooks, just these movies that can live in a real, in terms of endearment, you know, yeah. sobbing, but also laughing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. You know,
David O. Russell stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like real emotional stuff that like
emotional just, but fucking funny. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
And, flips
yeah.
back and forth.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's always the balance that I'm looking for. As an actor too, it's always the balance I'm looking for.
Yeah,
that's
I love that.
Where I live.
So what ended up because so to go back to my what ended up becoming the first professional acting gig that you had that you went up for and you got.
Well, professional's a funny word.
Well, you know, that you got paid that you got a paycheck that you had to fill out a W-4 or whatever, you know.
Well, I'll tell you about two. One, the first one I got paid for, and then there's the first one I did, which was even better. But the first one I got paid for, I believe, was a Michelob beer commercial.
Wow.
And I got on set, and the guy told me, okay, you're at the bar here. The guy, the director, said, you're at the bar here.
The guy.
And, yeah, that guy, some guy said, you're at the bar. I said, okay, this guy says I'm at the bar. And you run into an old professor of yours, and you guys have a conversation, and you know you're happy to see him. And I was so fucking tight. I was so nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 26 years old. I mean, I'm not young, you know. And and I had kind of staked my life on this path. Like I wasn't going to get my PhD. I wasn't going to be a professor. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to do this thing, and I'm going to be good at it.
Oh,
now
no.
I get on set, and I'm like. I'm just tight.
Because you feel like you needed to do so much?
I just didn't know. I didn't know it was going to be so fucking tight.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, man. I know
you
exactly.
You needed that joint.
It wasn't that. Yeah. Kid, I needed that. It wasn't like, you know, oh, I'm in the right place.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
It was like, no, I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah.
I'm in the wrong place.
The camera's pointed at you. That boom guy comes in. Yeah.
I can't do, I can't go on, I can't lie on the ground and go, ha.
Right.
So, there's pretzels there, and I toss one up, you know, catch it in my mouth. And the director's like, I love that.
Oh, no.
And I just remember, that was my lifeline. And I was like, so I did it for like 10 minutes, and then I just remember the director going, okay with the pretzels. We got the pretzels.
I thought you were going to say you could never get it in your mouth again.
That I could do.
Yeah.
So that was the first paying job was Michelob. The first job that I remember was my acting class went, and my acting class put on a night of one acts, and I decided to adapt this Charles Bukowski short story called The Copulating Mermaid of Venice, California.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Sure. As one does.
Sean's always referencing that.
Yeah.
It's a painting Sean has.
I just call it Mermaid. Yeah.
Yeah. So in this story, these two guys... kind of unemployed guys watch the hearse unload at the Venice morgue. This is not a true kind of geographical thing, but they can see it from the beach. And they know the timing of it. They know when the guys are going to come around. They know when the body's going to be unattended, and they're going to steal a body. Hmm. So they do. They steal a body. And they, you know, and here's where, you know, it's Bukowski, and it's like the logic kind of fails you. But they open it up, and it's a beautiful woman, and I decide I'm going to have sex with her. And then I'm so ashamed of myself that I force my buddy to have sex with her. And then,
jeez.
You sure you have this on your wall, Sean? I'm not sure.
No. Sure. It's how
you
I
should see the poster. It's bizarre.
So then I said, we go, what are we going to do with the body? I don't know. I swim her out to the ocean to get rid of the body. And then I come back and I say, she wasn't dead. She turned into a mermaid. She was beautiful. She swam away. So it's this like beautiful, not beautiful after this. It's this gross, horrible necrophilia. And then coupled with this high romantic, it's just Bukowski. Right?
Yeah.
So we decide we're going to do it. And I ask, the class, you know, which of the women in the class is going to be the corpse? And everybody's like, yeah, it'll be me. But then when the time comes to do it, nobody shows to be the corpse and we're stuck. And we had been, the place where we were making these plays was it was an S&M dungeon.
Sure.
Wow.
You know, of course.
And, they're not used during the day. And so.
Well, they're not used during the day. And we got to use it for two nights by cleaning up. We had to clean up. And that was a whole other different
gross
story.
Yeah.
But there was the madam there was named Magda. And she heard that we didn't have a body. So she said, why don't you use one of my blow-up dolls?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
This is how things happen. Mm-hmm. So
they're at Yale.
So, oh, she, yeah, right. And I'm thinking, maybe I should have stayed at Yale.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had always put up like a bulwark on front of the stage to lay a body down so nobody could see the body. They couldn't see what was going on when mm-hmm. I was supposedly making love to this body. And so I had this blow-up doll. And what I hadn't been able to rehearse with her.
Sure.
And
sure. She wasn't available.
So she didn't know her lines or anything.
As I was copulating with her,
sure.
Her arms and legs started flying out. Because she's only made of air, right? So the audience sees this.
Sure.
Like a used car lot. The things that use car lots.
Yeah. I'm trying to do this most intense scene. Young actor, like I'm really like, sure. Oh, I'm fucking edgy.
Yeah,
and these arms are going, and the audience is laughing and laughing. And so, in between performances, I went to Paragon. I hope you know it. It's a sporting goods
sure,
store.
Sure, very well.
And I got four ankle weights, and I weighed down her wrists and her ankles. So the next time she didn't have as much movement.
But she still had the squeaky.
The other part of it was when I walked through the audience, and I put a pail of water off stage where I was going to go because I swim around and I got to be wet. And so I walk through the audience and I'm sure the audience is like, oh my God, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's right. I'm an edgy motherfucker. Uh-huh. And I go around the corner to, and I realize it's totally quiet. There's no door. They can just hear me sponging myself down back there. They can just hear me.
Oh my God. Dude.
So that was my first play.
How long did it last?
Those two nights.
Okay, great.
Those two
nights. Full nights. Two full nights. So you do the Bukowski where you're, as you described, making love to an inflatable doll in an S&M dungeon.
Yeah.
You do the Michelob.
You threw away a PhD at Yale for this. This is what I hear my mother saying.
Yeah, your parents must have been, at this point, they're beaming with pride. And so then, but then what's the sort of the first, because I'm leading up to X-Files, because I want to get into X-Files a little bit. We'd be remiss if we didn't get into X-Files because I was a fan of X-Files and
huge.
I watched it.
Yeah,
So you get that, and that leads to what? Because what was the first film you did?
An old girlfriend of mine whose name is Maggie Wheeler. That's her married name. She's mm-hmm. a terrific actress. She was on...
Want to give an address or
Friends
phone
quite a lot.
Got first and last, okay.
She's on Friends. She was Janice on Friends.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Chandler's
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Maggie was doing this film with Henry Jaglom, who just passed last week. And Henry's this maverick independent filmmaker.
Yeah.
And Maggie was going to be one of the three stars of this film called New Year's Day. And she asked Henry, you know, David's acting now. Can you see if you can put him in? So Henry did. And I had a couple scenes in the movie and they were good. They were kind of notable enough to kind of get me going here in LA and get an agent. And, you know, at that point it was like, it wasn't like get your SAG card. It was like, how do I get film on myself? You know,
how do I show
people that I'm not a vampire and I don't disappear when I'm
Well, people film. Didn't have, they didn't have phones and you couldn't put shit on YouTube the way kids can now and create their own stuff.
Right.
It was one long scene in New Year's Day that really kind of opened it up for me in LA. And then I auditioned forever here and didn't get tons of stuff and would get, you know.
So you moved to LA.
Feedback.
You moved to LA to go all in.
Exactly.
What were you doing to pay the bills while you were swinging and missing?
I was doing commercials. Okay. I would get commercials. Yeah.
So no waiting tables, no bartending,
I bartended. Yeah. I catered.
Yeah.
Where did you live when you were here in LA?
I lived on 4th Street in Santa Monica. I got a sublet there.
I had an
efficiency apartment, which means it didn't have a kitchen, which means I did my dishes in the shower when I had my shower. Uh-huh.
David.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, dishwashing liquid is pretty good.
Wait, 4th and what? I lived on Ocean Park and 2nd for years.
4th between California and Washington.
Yeah,
right by the stairs, you know, like, sure. That was my gym. I'd go to the stairs. And
I catered, too. I catered for a wedding at Anthony Edwards' house when I just moved here. And I was like, oh, my God, it's the guy from ER, and I'm in his kitchen.
Yeah.
It was so wild.
Yeah. And then you were shooting pretty much next door to him when you guys were doing Will and Grace, right?
That's right. It was crazy. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And you did a lot. Shani, you did a lot of commercials, too, back in the day. I remember.
Tons, yeah. It's the only way to pay the bills.
We talked about, remember you had those commercials that you were doing, like, when Will and Grace was on, some of them came out.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, isn't that weird? Yeah.
That
was wild. I had two commercials, two on the Super Bowl in 1998.
What were they?
One was a Bud Light commercial.
I did a Bud Light commercial.
Oh, really? When?
Yes. 87, 88.
Well, 89. You did Miller Lite and Bud Light.
Yeah.
Michelob.
Look at you. No, Michelob.
I did Michelob and Bud Light. I was all over the beers.
Look at you.
I was king of beers.
Wait, so David, when did you, because I'm a big sci-fi nerd.
So X-Files, that's what you're getting to, right, Shani? How did X-Files
I know you're sick of talking about it,
I know you are.
But
forgive us. We're just fans.
I didn't ask. But I'm ready to listen.
Jason read the books.
Yeah, it was just an audition. And I remember at that point, I was not wanting to do television. Mm. You know, at that point, there was a real divide between television actors and movie actors, which has been erased in the past few years or the past 20 years. So it was really, I'm not a TV actor. That was my sense.
Who was your North Star in film? Who did you want to be?
Well, I didn't want to be Brando, but he was my North Star.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Right.
Did you ever write any of the X-Files?
Yeah, I did.
I
wrote and directed two or three of them, yeah.
Well, that's
one
cool.
One of them's a baseball one, Jason. I can't believe we haven't made this.
I know.
We'll be right back.
And now back to the show.
So wait, so you get this gig and you sign the 5-year or 7-year standard thing before you go in and you test.
Five,
so you know that if you get this, you're stuck with something that you're not really kind of excited about. Then you get it.
Are you excited when you get it because of that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you're not excited to think it's going to go forever, which is a blessing when it does, but you get competitive. You know, you just like, if I'm going to do it, I want it to win. I want it to go.
You do the pilot, you want it to get picked up. And
every step
and then
of the way.
Then it gets well received and you're like, well, all right. Now
so,
I'm fucking
Can I just stop for Tracy? Can I just say, so the testing process, so you don't know, Jason just alluded to and David knows, we all know. It used to be, I don't know if it still is the way, but what would happen is you'd go in for a show, whether it's X-Files or Will and Grace or whatever it is, and you'd get the audition and you'd go through and then you'd get a call back and you'd read for producers. Then what they do is they sort of take, for any given role, they might have 3 or 4 people who they decide that they're going to, as they call it, bring to the network.
Yeah.
And that means that they're kind of their select pick, 3 or 4 people for each role. And before you go and do this final audition, usually like in a conference room or something, an office building, the most uninspiring place you can imagine, before you do that, for a day or two before, your agents and the show negotiate your contract, a 5-year contract, and you sign it before you go in for
lobby.
The final audition in the lobby.
Right before you walk in.
So they got you.
So you're broke, and then your agent goes like, here's your contract. We've agreed you're going to get $25,000 an episode for the next 5 years.
It's a lottery ticket.
Yeah, and you're like, oh my God, I'm so broke, and I'm going to get $25,000 an episode for the next 5 years, and you're doing the math, and you're like, and then I'm going to buy it. I'm going to buy a new car.
And if you weren't nervous before, you're petrified
now. And you sign it, and then you go, once you sign it, they take the signed, executed contract.
So that you have no leverage if they give you the job.
You go in, and you then audition for all the execs at the network, And then you're waiting and they decide whether or not you got the part. So, they have you so over the barrel. You never realize you're never not over the barrel in that process. And it's really uninspiring. And it's a very specific thing to get good at that, to be able to block that part of it out, to then go and deliver at the final moment. You're kind of torture. Yeah, you're fighting out of a hole, right?
What if after that, David was like, it was an offer? But anyway,
it wasn't enough. So, David,
your process is you're a little conflicted about doing a TV series, but you want to do, and it's a great paycheck. So you go in and you sign the contract, you do the test. Yeah. Now you do the pilot.
Yeah.
Right. And so then now they've got the executed thing. And then the network, sorry, again, for Tracy, then they decide from all their pilots what shows are going to make it on the air next year.
Yeah.
So you're waiting for a month or two for that.
Yeah.
And then they go, great, your show is happening, you're in it, and we've got you for 5 years. And then what happens a lot is you go, oh my God, this is so great, I'm going to make $20,000 or $25,000 an episode. And then 2 years in, if you're lucky enough that it's going, you're like, hey man, I deserve way more than $20,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I got to get out of here. I got to stay available for all the feature opportunities I think are out there waiting for me.
David, so you know that process, right? Like, yeah. So you're there and you're doing X-Files and you guys come out of the gate pretty hot. It's kind of a hit. Am I right or wrong?
It's a hit on Fox. And if you can remember that far back, Fox was really like not a real network at that point.
Yeah, right. It just started.
It was like 93.
They didn't have programming, you know, across the board all day long, really. And, you know, they had Married with Children and I can't remember, you know, they had made
Simpsons,
90210.
Tracy Ullman.
Yeah, that's right.
But they were really not the upstart network. So
they didn't have a big drama kind of like.
No, not at all. And we didn't need to get like huge numbers to be a hit for Fox, which was nice because Fox wasn't even in all the homes.
Who was running Fox at the time when you guys were there? Do you remember?
Who was running it?
Oh, Garth Hanciere?
Who?
Was it Garth Hanciere?
No, he was at NBC, I think.
He was one of the starters of Fox. Yeah. I can't believe you remember that name, Jay.
Or was it WB?
He didn't want me for a gig, and I had to re-audition. You ready for this? My buddy Michael Malley's show. We did the pilot. I get the pilot. We do it. We shoot it. It gets picked up to series,
and then
he didn't want me. And I had to go back.
Sandy Gershaw.
Two months later.
It might have been Sandy.
Yeah. I had to go back 2 months later and re-audition for a part and do a scene in a conference room, a scene holding up pages that I had already filmed.
Terrible.
That existed on film to get my
crazy.
Job.
Terrible.
That's crazy.
In a conference room in Burbank.
That's
and
crazy.
And I'm like, wait, you don't need to see me do this in the room.
Do you remember what year that was, Will?
1999.
That's when I first met you.
Yeah.
I met you at the Upfronts.
Yeah, that year. That's right.
Yeah.
All the upfronts.
Did you get it, Will?
I did, actually. Yeah.
Oh, again.
Well done.
Yeah, I got it again.
You imitated yourself. And
what
a
fucking victory. Do you think I had, I think I counted, I think I had 1,000 beers that night.
That's not enough.
Wait, David, were you a sci-fi fan when you got it? Or
no.
Not, and are you now? Not at all.
No.
Wow, how about that?
No, not really.
So you get X-Files, you go up to Vancouver, you guys start doing it. It's a hit for Fox. And then it really starts to, when's the moment you can feel that it's kind of pushed through to the general?
Probably like the third year, just globally.
Oh.
It felt just huge, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was a global hit.
Yeah, massive.
How did you like relocating up into Vancouver for so long?
Well, I loved it at first.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really have any roots in Los Angeles. You know, I just, I had come here to try to get work.
And you weren't going to, the blow up doll wasn't going to start crying. I mean, they can perform a lot of duties, but tears are not one.
I'm not going to speak for her. She, you know.
Jesus Christ.
But I will tell you.
So I hear. This is what I hear.
This is
what
we hear. Yeah. Oh my God.
So I don't know how you guys feel about Vancouver, but it's a beautiful part of the world. And I just
never been.
Stanley Park.
You've never been?
I've never been. I want to go so bad.
How is that possible?
It's the greatest.
It's so beautiful.
I loved it. And I didn't mind being out of LA at all. I just loved being up there. And in a way, we got to just focus on doing the work. There wasn't any kind of LA around us. There wasn't any kind of that. Whatever heat that was happening, we were kind of cut off from in a really good way. And in many ways, it was my education as an actor, having to go to work every damn day
yeah.
for 14 hours. I mean, these were really long days. And I really taught myself how to act.
How soon into the run of it and the success of it did you start thinking, all right, good here, ready to move on and maybe parlay some of this into, you know, what did you have your eyes on? Was it still features?
Yeah, I mean, that was really, you know, I had that kind of bias, you know, that was kind of baked in from a young age. Mm-hmm. You know, the TV shows that I watched when I was a kid, it was quantitatively different, acting in it, you know, that it's not the way now.
But I just remember you had very much a movie style of acting. In other words, you're very subtle.
Well, that's how I would not get, that's why I didn't get, I would audition and not get any roles in television.
Right, exactly.
They would say, he's a movie star. And I was too small. Fuck, I don't have a pot to piss in either. Mm-hmm. So can you get,
good that you didn't
can
change.
I please play Puppet Man? Can I get that part? Puppet
Man. Right. David, I want to ask you about like time management because you're a musician. You literally write novels, which is amazing. You act, you do some other stuff I'm sure you haven't mentioned. How do you manage all of that on a daily basis or weekly or monthly or whatever? Do you pick a priority that you focus on or just do you splice it?
Whatever's like in front of me is what I'll do. Songwriting can happen at any time. Pick up a guitar. But with writing a novel, everything has to stop and I have to work on that for a few months. I write really fast but it's an intense experience of like 8-hour days doing that. And then of course I can't write when I'm acting. I can't write when I'm directing. Right.
Do you have a goal in your mind that is louder than all the other goals and that then informs how you allocate your time?
That's probably the problem that I have is I don't really have a goal except to satisfy some kind of itch or
and that's a daily itch, not a weekly or a monthly or
no, it's a lifelong kind of a thing. It's just for instance, like I want to make a series out of one of the novels that I've written, and that's really my greatest ambition at this point. But there's also a movie I'm shooting in February that I wrote, but I'm not directing; I'm just acting in. So
and you've got a new series airing now. I think we're
Malice,
in November,
right?
Oh, really?
Hey, thanks for not having me on the live show.
I mean,
dude, that's for movie stars, bro.
I'm pretty good on my feet. Malice. It's Amazon. Comes out, I'm not sure, November 3rd or something like that.
What's it called again?
Malice.
Malice.
Okay.
Yeah, it's coming out in November on Amazon. And by the way, David, we'll get you a seat in one of the, we have these new stage seats that we're going to do on the live show.
I was listening.
I've always wondered this. We've had people on who have been part of something that's sort of really struck a chord, you know, culturally, the pieces, as Sean would say, IP, but part of, and X-Files, obviously over a number of years, you know, has this intense following and I was one of the followers. I used to watch it religiously back in the 90s. When I saw the film, I saw the first film. I didn't see the second film.
Samba.
The first film was a big hit. Is there that thing when you run into people who are big fans of it, do you ever feel a responsibility as the sort of the caretaker of that thing of X-Files? I don't want to say there's a burden, but like you're the guy, you're the front-facing face person of the X-Files.
Do you feel that, yeah.
Well, of course there was a time when I wanted to leave it behind, and reinvent myself. But then over the years, You begin to respect the kind of power of the show and the size of the show and the meaning that it has for people. Mm. You know, at first when you're younger, you think, oh, it's not because of me, but it's personal. And then you realize it's not personal. It's just that this thing has a place in people's lives and I represent that to them.
Yeah,
and I'm an asshole if I don't respect that.
I just say that all the time.
David's
about you.
An asshole?
No, I'm kidding. No, I do say it a lot. I do say that all the time. I said it before on here where you become famous for playing a certain role or in a movie or whatever it is, and then you spend several years trying to distance yourself that because you want to be able to play all these things, and in doing so, you alienate the fans that made you, kind of,
because they are in love with you because of the thing that, like you just said, that you made them feel. And you're doing a disservice. And I always say that I'm an asshole if I don't embrace the character Jack from Will and Grace and what it did for so many people.
I'm sorry,
all that.
What character is that?
No, exactly. Exactly.
You're also depriving yourself the treat that you deserve,
right?
Yeah. Which is like
all of it.
How rare it is to be a part of
it's
something
very
that
rare.
Holds
that's
holds
right.
A spot
very
for
that's
people.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
It is rare, and you get old enough to appreciate that that you got to do something that was yeah. great that did strike a chord with people.
And when you're young, you don't think like that. It takes a few years to go, oh, I need to appreciate that more. And
no, it's funny. I read somebody, I made the mistake, David, of reading a comment a while ago with somebody saying, like, he thinks that he doesn't, that he should have had more of a thing or whatever about me. And I was like, no, motherfucker, I'm so grateful for any time that I was able to do anything
right.
that
yeah,
even
for sure.
anybody liked for a moment. What right. a joke.
Yeah, right. Yeah. yeah. I mean, and I'm a guy, I don't even have my high school diploma. Like, the fact that
I deserve,
still, like,
I don't think I deserve. Stop the bragging, world doesn't owe me. I know. The world doesn't owe me a living. We're so lucky that we've right. been able to do this
so
at
lucky.
All. It's
yeah.
so
yeah.
not the way I think
now,
about it.
Now, I'd like to ask a question that Sean's too shy to ask. Did you ever learn anything doing the X-Files
Here
that gives
go.
You any sort of confidence that we are not alone?
Yes. And Sean promises not to tell anybody if you could just tell
us. It's just us four talking.
I never learned anything, no. But I have the same kind of sense is when I went into it, which is, it seems to me that the impossibility would be that we are the only sentient
yeah,
life.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
Amen.
Just too many totally. Galaxies, too many planets, too many Goldilocks planets.
Right.
So the odds to me are slanted way in favor of the existence of extraterrestrials, whether or not, we haven't advanced technologically enough to reach out to them.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they
might be all around us and we just don't have the technology to see it.
Right.
Well, they
right.
don't want us to I always look at it, when you see all these things, these congressional hearings and stuff about pilots
yeah.
who run into these shapes or things that are moving in ways that we can't understand. I always think, oh, we're so dumb. We think that they want to, that we need to connect. And they're like, no. You guys.
We're good.
Yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
We're watching you. We're just watching you guys.
We don't want to have anything to do with you.
Ripping yeah. over yourselves like a bunch of ding-dongs.
Didn't we have, a guy on once that had, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said something that was really sort of interesting that makes a lot of sense to me, that perhaps they are all around us in a way that we can't see, just like our cell phone service or radio waves, from like television mm-hmm. with
yeah,
gravity
it's right
or whatever.
Here.
Live in
it's
space
just flying all around
space.
Us. You don't see any of the ones and zeros or whatever the hell it is that fly around that make our phones. They could be all in that stuff.
Yeah, they live in the space between the space.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
The dark
yeah.
matter.
The yes. dark matter.
The dark matter.
I used to say this thing with, are you aware of like the phenomenon of like a ship of fools? Do you remember that from the Middle Ages where?
It was a great Robert Plant song. Is that?
Is it?
A Razor song.
It could be. But the idea was that they would take their deviants and criminals, their incorrigible criminals, and they'd put them on a ship, because they didn't have space for them. They just put them on a ship out to sea.
Floating Australia.
And sometimes. And, well, sometimes, you'd encounter a ship of fools and it wasn't a fun thing, right?
Right.
Well, they weren't armed. They shouldn't be armed.
No. They made sure they were armed.
But my theory about, because so much of alien abduction testimony has to do with being probed anally and having their teeth drilled,
sure.
My theory was that alien civilizations were putting their deviants and dentists on a ship.
Oh, I see.
Okay,
and
very good.
Sending it out into the galaxy, and somehow they've
good
come into
our
We can cut it. This. We can cut this. But why are aliens so obsessed with anal? Okay,
yeah.
so
why would you want to cut that?
Why would you want to offend them when you get any comments?
David, what do you do? So if you're not reading and you're not writing and you're not writing music and writing screenplays and doing all this stuff, what is this is sort of the Sean question that what are you doing? And is there anything you do in your downtime that you're like, what's your guilty pleasure?
We'd be surprised to learn.
What do you do in the space between the space?
Is it gardening?
Ooh. Nice.
Anything dumb that you do, you go like, oh man, I'd be embarrassed if people knew I did this stupid thing.
I don't really. I'm I'm so bad with hobbies. I really should have a hobby. It's really a problem.
Well, you have, you do 25,000 things.
It's really a problem.
Are you playing basketball? Are you playing golf?
I wish.
Are you cross-country skiing? Or what
I
are you
wish
doing?
I was playing basketball.
Yeah.
No, now I feel bad. I do need a hobby.
Oh, shit.
And when people like me, when dummies like me are watching television, you're reading? So you're not watching
I watch. I watch TV. I'm watching Black Rabbit. Come on.
Oh, hey.
Black Rabbit airing now on Netflix, starring Jason and Jude Law. Aggregate Films brings you Black Rabbit. Two brothers.
So it's not like you're not watching Below Deck or anything like that.
No, but I do watch. I'll watch a Love Island.
Sure.
Oh, you do?
But then I realize 45 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a 15-hour season.
No.
I mean, they make... Somehow they make 45 fucking hours.
You get
out of
stuck
that
in there.
But so you watch baseball. Is there another? Is that your number one sport to watch?
Basketball is probably not my number one sport.
The Lakers are going to be good this year.
It could be.
Okay.
Who's your team? Knicks?
The Knicks. Yeah.
Now, you're not in New York now. Where do you live?
I live in LA.
Okay. Yeah. Why the Knicks?
Because I grew up in New York, and it's just right.
Were you not awake when we started the podcast?
there was some doll fucking and stuff like that there
that just puts you in kind of a state.
I figured that was just an hourly thing that you were doing
doll
in New
really
York.
Stayed with you, huh?
How are we going to side this text show? You. This is terrible. I'm just glad he's not live.
What if that's the next time we watch Jason on TV at the Dodgers game, he's sitting next to a blow up doll?
Oh my God! He was the other day.
With the next Files T-shirt up.
Wait, David, I have an idea for you.
Okay.
Come on.
So because you write novels and you're not a sci-fi thing, you want to sell a lot of copies of something, do Bucky fucking Dent was baseball adjacent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do whatever you do brilliantly and just make a little sci-fi adjacent thing. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit, right?
Well, that episode of The X-Files that I wrote and directed that I want Jason to watch because it's called The Unnatural. And it's a baseball.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, all right.
So you'll have to. I did that.
Wilford Brimley do a cameo in that at all?
No, but
Wilford Brimley.
M. Emmett Walsh.
Wow.
Wow.
That's pretty. That's it. Yeah. That's Wilford R.I.P. Brimley adjacent.
Yeah.
I love M. Emmett Walsh. Yeah. By the way, fantastic. Just as a quick aside.
And
he
was fantastic. And he
did he give you a $2 bill?
He didn't.
No, he does that. Shit. He does that with a lot of folks, or did. I had one, and then
we just made David feel bad again. This is
this was before $2 bills were being made.
Not hard to make me feel bad, but he replaced an actor who got ill. So he had short notice, and it was a lot of dialogue. His character was really the exposition man in this episode, and at one point he turned to me. Because I only think he had a couple days with the script. He goes, and he said, "This isn't writing, it's typing." I was like, "Well, I did the typing, so."
Thanks a lot.
And at one point, he fucked up. It was so great. Instead of calling me Agent Mulder, he called me Agent MacGyver. And I kept it in.
Did you really?
Oh yeah. It was too good.
That guy was so good. I just remember what was the one he did
Blood
with
Simple?
Michael Keaton? No, the great Clean and Sober.
Yeah,
and he was also in Fletch.
Yes, right.
He was the doctor in Fletch. He was a fantastic guy. David, you're fantastic.
Yeah,
you're fantastic.
We rarely go over. We've gone over with you because we love talking to you. Malice is out. Amazon Prime. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention that again.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And
I plug Black Rabbit again? Should I do that?
Please. Please.
What service is that on? And we have
where do we find that?
Yeah.
Very, very nice of you to share some of your time,
David,
with us, sir.
I'm so glad we did this. I'm so
what a joy.
Glad. Thank you for coming on.
I love your show, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. You guys are
thank
great.
You for coming
thank
on.
Thank you, David.
Actor, writer, screenwriter, novelist,
musician,
academic, musician,
smarty pants,
an all-around great guy. David Duchovny, thank you so much, David, for your time.
Thank
it's been a joy having you.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Double D. Double D comes
Double D.
To the Smartless studio, I guess is what this is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the Smartless studio.
Yeah.
Smartless is shot in front of a live studio audience.
He's real slick and cool.
He's just, well, he's confident because he's smart. When you're smart, you're confident. He's very confident. And,
I didn't know half that stuff. That's amazing.
Because you're not smart. You're not smart.
That's true.
I'm like, how uncool
I mean, it is true. I mean, think about it. He graduated like head of his class in high school, and you know, he goes to Princeton, then he goes to Yale, and he gets a master's in English literature, and then he starts to work on his PhD. And while he's working on his PhD, he's like,
it's a Michelob spot.
Yeah, I'm gonna go over there. I'm gonna go and start doing some acting lessons just to sort of see how that is.
But could you imagine being his parents? And you're like, oh boy, baby, we hit the lotto. Look at this kid. We can't wait to brag about this with our friends, blah, blah, blah. And then they go see his first job. Oh, he's become an actor. And he's fucking this goddamn doll. Inflatable.
I mean, there's nothing more disappointing than just going, I want to be an actor. And you're like, Christ.
All right. Yeah. Well, maybe he's good. Hopefully he's good. And then they go see his banging this doll.
Yeah. I know.
No.
I
know. But he landed on his feet.
He did.
You know?
Boy, did he ever. He landed on his feet a few times. Yeah, he's such a... We didn't even get into Californication. He's just done so much. God damn.
He did some movies, too.
He did a bunch of movies, and he's just...
He's got this new show. New show called Malice.
Malice.
What do you think it's about?
What do I think...
What do you think Malice is about? Is it about a guy's girlfriend who and her name is Alice... And it's like it's M apostrophe Alice.
Alice.
Yeah. No, this is my Alice.
No,
this is my Alice.
This is my Alice.
Yeah. Maybe it's about that.
It could be. Why don't we just throw everybody off? Yeah.
Bennett suggested this is. Jason, you said he landed on his feet. Maybe on his bipartite sesamoids.
Which is
what is this?
The symptoms and treatment options are. It's from the Melbourne podiatrist. No,
landed.
You're not
going
to take bipartite.
No.
No. All right.
Have you seen the new show? By chance?
We're not saying that. How are you doing that? How are you overruling with that? With just like
I tried to tee you guys up with, you know, what do you think Malice is about? I thought maybe one of you ding dongs had a bio.
Oh, you know what? Well, I thought you I don't know what it is. Is it a biopic?
About a guy's girlfriend named Alice.
Whose whistle was that?
Who's that the whistle?
That's great.
That's really good.
Oh, we got to start adding the whistle.
Smart. Less.
Smart. Less. Smartless is 100% organic and artisanally handcrafted by Rob Armjarf, Bennett Barbaco, and Michael Grant Terry.
Smart. Less.